Poetry on the Radio. Poetry in and around the ACT. Today, the first of three installments featuring Canberra-based poet Keith Harrison's thoughts on poetry, plus The Rhyming Bugle, poetry news from around the ACT region. For Artsound FM Community Radio, I'm Peter Searles. Today, and on the next two episodes of Poetry on the Radio, the thoughts of poet and particularly astute poetry thinker Keith Harrison. He'll talk about poetic craft and reception. You can read all about Keith Harrison in his experimental memoir, Not Quite Ithaca, which he published in 2023 with his own Black Willow Press. He tells of a rich life in letters, including his many acquaintanceships with such figures as Peter Porter, John Stallworthy, Ted Hughes, Sylvia Plath. From 1968 to his retirement in 1996, he was a professor of English and writer-in-residence at Carleton College in Minnesota. There, from 1977 to 1980, he was editor-in-chief of the acclaimed literary quarterly, The Carleton Miscellany, during its last years of publication. We'll talk more about Keith Harrison later in the program, but here he is. His subject today, poetry and silence.
Hello and very good day to everyone. Today, I want to introduce you to some poems you won't know and some that I suspect you will. First, let's take a trip into the Australian countryside at the time of harvesting, grape harvesting in this case, when the sky is often completely cloudless, there's no wind, and all we hear is the thrum of the grape press. It's late afternoon, and the poem I'm going to share with you is called Blue Song, After Harvesting, and it goes like this. Still the air, and still the hawks, hanging over plucked vine stalks. Noon widens like the aftersound of a struck gong. Days go round slow, slow, and the grapes are in, all crushed and seething in their bin. And now the rush of molecules that no one understands nor rules begins again and gathers power. And we lean back in the blue hour. Now the workmen are scrubbing clean the duckboards round the stopped machine. While up here on the hill, their words drift through the branches like ghost birds. Still the window with its rose, and we lean back and dream and doze. Have you ever felt when someone's reading a poem aloud in a reading that you're missing something? Everything happens too quickly, and here you are in the middle of the next poem and you're still trying to absorb the last one. I've often felt that way because a poem needs some space so that we can let the meaning grow in our mind. So I'm going to read that one again. Still the air, and still the hawks hanging over plucked vine stalks. Noon widens like the aftersound of a struck gong. Days go round slow, slow, and the grapes are in, all crushed and seething in their bin. And now the rush of molecules that no one understands nor rules begins again and gathers power. And we lean back in the blue hour. Now the workmen are scrubbing clean the duckboards round the stopped machine. While up here on the hill, their words drift through the branches like ghost birds. Still the window with its rose, and we lean back and dream and doze. Today I want to talk about sound and silence and how we read. It's an interesting fact that without silence you can't have intelligible sound. What you get when you read fast, as you do with a newspaper, is something like what happens in a busy restaurant, a constant blur of noise. In good verbal communication there are clear edges, and those edges are born out of silence, which is a kind of womb in which the sounds are born and grow. But sounds in a poem need to be heard properly before they can be understood, and when the world itself is full of sound, as it often is, it's very difficult to keep one's thoughts clear, let alone poems. I discovered last year that the only thing still used in France from the old verb ouïr, which is closely related to the English word hear, is the past participle, oui, which means heard. So not long ago, understanding was very closely related to the act of hearing, and we preserve that idea when we say, I hear you. This is why when we read poetry only with the eye, our understanding tries to keep pace with the movement of our eye, and we can't do that. We need some space. As I thought about this, I remembered what I'd learned from a great Indian writer called A.K. Kumaraswamy, who taught us in his book The Bugbear of Literary, which is a very provocative book, which I urge you to read sometime, that in Tibet there are thousands of people who can't understand anything written down on a page, but can nonetheless remember enormous stretches of poetry because they've learnt it by listening carefully to their elders. In that cultural tradition, they believe that when you write down poems, it's really only a minor thing that you're doing. Why would you want to do that if you can remember the words of a poem exactly? In that culture, tradition had it that writing poems down was really a minor concern. Why would you want to do that if you can remember the words of a poem exactly? Then I thought about Heinrich Schliemann, who some of you will know discovered the site of ancient Troy in 1973. After this triumphal act, he was looking for a wife, and he wrote an advertisement for the local Greek newspaper which specified that applicants should be young and beautiful, and that, more important, they should know the Iliad by heart. You'll be surprised that there were 18 applicants, and he, of course, chose the most beautiful one. But she also knew the Iliad. Even in modern, fast-paced Italy, so I've heard, there are many people who can still recite the whole of the Divine Comedy without looking at the text. And hand on heart, I knew two people in my undergraduate days, one a student, the other a renowned professor, who could do the same with the whole of Paradise Lost. Most of us find it difficult to remember a whole page, even if we want to. In fact, someone claimed that mankind in this late Anthropocene era is a species who's lost its memory. Since the invention of the printing press, and for a number of other reasons, we've all become obedient citizens of what I'd like to call the kingdom of the eye. Early in the 20th century, the American poet Ezra Pound tried to entice us into a new way of reading. First with his translations of some of the early poems from Provence in southern France, and a bit later in his versions of some of the classical poems of China, which he published in a book called Cathay. In these works he achieved something which was quite new. What he did was very subtle, and I want to illustrate it by sharing a tiny poem of 1,000 years ago. It's called Fan Piece, for her imperial lord. Imagine you're the wife of a Chinese emperor, and as in many countries at many times, as a woman you're quite insignificant. You sit there demurely as the emperor looms above you as he speaks, and you are utterly powerless. But there is one thing you can do. In the privacy of your bedroom, you can inscribe a poem on your fan. And this is what it might say. O fan of white silk, clear as frost on the grass blade, you are also laid aside. Read on the page, it doesn't strike us as particularly unusual, but if we slow it down and really listen to the words, we notice something striking. Pound is revealing the full meaning of the poem through some carefully chosen sounds. We notice the F's and the almost silence they produce. Fan of white silk, clear as frost on the grass blade. Then we notice the liquid L's in clear and silk. Then much more dramatically we catch what Pound does with the D's in blade and laid and aside. These sounds don't occur by chance in the translation. What Pound is doing is enacting the meaning of the poem with the sounds he chooses. The Empress first of all places her shut fan on her lap, laid. Then she shifts it very slightly, then and stops it altogether with laid aside. Pound's taught us a very simple lesson, but a very profound one. Language is a medium that has only two elements, vowels and consonants. And Pound is negotiating his way among them very carefully. It's no wonder that T.S. Eliot dedicated The Wasteland to Pound, whom he called il miglior fabbro, the better craftsman. We could put what I've been saying like this. The eye is a relentless socialist among meanings. It flattens all the vowels and consonants into a kind of rapid informational drone. But a poem is more than information, and with a good poem, our usual kind of reading misses a great deal. Let's take an example by homing in on number 138, a very provocative sonnet of Shakespeare, whose first lines go like this. When my love swears that she is made of truth, I do believe her, though I know she lies. All very well, and we picked up some of the meanings, but I read it too fast. Read more slowly, it gives us a great deal more. When my love swears, and that strikes us as odd, and we think about it, then we move forward to made of truth and realise there's a little game unfolding here because the sound made has a double and even a triple meaning. His love is composed of truth, made of truth, and or she is a maid of truth, which is a much different idea, and it also suggests the word maiden, invoking an innocence which the rest of the poem belies. So now we have to read the line somewhat like this. When my love swears that she is made of truth, I do believe her, though I know she lies. This is very odd. You believe your lover, even though you know she's lying to you. Questions and puzzles arise. Then if you go on listening as the poem continues, you're led to make changes with your voice to accommodate the meanings, and you might hear something very different. So I'll give you the poem from the very beginning. When my love swears that she is made of truth, I do believe her, though I know she lies. That she might think me some untutored youth, unlearned in the world's false subtleties. Thus, vainly thinking that she thinks me young, although she knows my days are past the best, simply I credit her false-speaking tongue. On both sides thus is simple truth suppressed. But wherefore says she not she is unjust? And wherefore say not I that I am old? Oh, love's best habit is in seeming trust, and love in years loves not to have years told. Therefore I lie with her, and she with me. And in our faults, by lies, we flattered be. Some really odd and interesting things are happening now, simply because you're inside the poem, and it's now a kind of verbal music which requires the poem not to be read with the eye, but performed with the voice. Now all sorts of new ideas appear, and they center around words like simply, and lies, and habit, and told, as in the tolling of a bell, and so on. I've been saying this poem to myself for many decades now, and I'm still surprised by how Shakespeare plays with the meanings and how the meanings keep shifting. All the words I've just pointed to have two very distinct connotations. It's as if he's gathering all the different ideas of love and deception and bringing them all together. So part of the fun in this and in many of the other sonnets is exploring the meanings with your voice. You emphasize some words and use silences to help the meanings you want to convey. The possibilities are almost inexhaustible, but you get very little of that if you read the poem only with the eye. There's a lot more to say on this, but I'll leave you to discover more of the poem yourself by reading it aloud in your own way, which is probably very different from mine. This is a poem which is very tricky and very clever, and your Tuesday interpretation will probably sound somewhat different from the way you read it on Monday. When I said it over again once this morning, I found it more disturbing than I'd ever thought before. It was only a small difference, but I had to change my inner and outer voice to accommodate that difference.
Today, in the first of three special episodes of Poetry on the Radio, Keith Harrison is sharing with us some thoughts on poetry and silence. More about Keith. He has published numerous books, including several volumes of poetry, among them Changes, New and Collected Poems, 1962 to 2002. Among his current projects is a new and Collected Poems. He has also translated Virgil, Catullus, Rilke, Lorca, Pushkin, Baudelaire, Francis Jam, and others. Several of his poems are online on his website in his own readings. His interests have included the art of versification and the task of essay writing. In pursuit of what he calls the difficult challenge of the public performance of poetry, he has worked with overtone chanting and voice instruments such as the didgeridoo. And here's another of Keith Harrison's many accomplishments. He has created a verse translation of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, the 14th century narrative poem set in the court of King Arthur. His translation first appeared in 1983 from the Folio Society. Good news for listeners is that Keith Harrison and Peter Monahan, producer of Poetry on the Radio, have created a radio drama version of Keith's translation of Sir Gawain, and it will air on ArtSound soon. Back to Keith.
Now a change of time zone. From Shakespeare we'll take a leap forward of 300 years or so. Some of you will have come across the poems of Robert Frost, who wrote a number of great poems, and I want to share with you one of the lesser-known ones, which, apart from other things, makes a wonderful use of both sounds and silence. The poem, like a lot of Frost's work, is set deep in the woods of Vermont, and it concerns an old man living completely alone in a small cabin. It's night, and it's been snowing heavily, and he feels his end drawing near. This is how the poem sounds. It's called An Old Man's Winter Night. All out of doors looked darkly in at him, through the thin frost, almost in separate stars that gathers on the pane in empty rooms. What kept his eyes from giving back the gaze was the lamp tilted near them in his hand. What kept him from remembering what it was that brought him to that creaking room was age. he stood with barrels round him, at a loss. And having scared the cellar under him in clomping there, he scared it once again in clomping off, and scared the outer night, which has its sounds, familiar, like the roar of trees and crack of branches. Common things, but nothing so like beating on a box. A light he was to no one but himself, where now he sat, concerned with he knew what, a quiet light, and then not even that. He consigned to the moon, such as she was, so late arising, to the broken moon, as better than the sun, in any case, for such a charge, his snow upon the roof, his icicles along the wall to keep, and slept. The log that shifted with a jolt once in the stove disturbed him, and he shifted and eased his heavy breathing, but still slept. An aged man, one man, can't fill a house, a farm, a countryside. Or, if he can, it's thus he does it of a winter night. The part that really fascinates me about this poem as a writer is what Frost does near the end with sound and silence and also rhythm. Frost not only has the old man lying down in front of the fire in an uneasy sleep, but he creates the feeling of the old man and his heaviness in the way he manipulates the music of the language. The log that shifted with a jolt once in the stove disturbed him, and he shifted and eased his heavy breathing, but still slept. We can sense the log falling suddenly with a small spray of sparks, and that rouses the old man, and he turns over, stretches his upper body and legs, and then a series of open vowels. He shifted and eased his heavy breathing as he settles down again. Frost's metrical craftsmanship here is so astute that we don't notice it until we read it over again. He was a very canny poet, and he knew exactly what he was doing, and it's very often much more sensitive and perceptive than we first thought when we just read it on the page. I'll be looking at more of Frost's poems in later programs, but I'll just mention now that Frost wrote all his poems in meter, and he once said that writing poems without a meter was like playing tennis without a net. Early on, he discovered a great paradox that served him well all his writing life. It was also known to Homer and Dante and thousands of other great poets, and it bears repeating. In accepting limits in his writing, by some alchemy that no one really understands, he found great freedom. Homer wrote all of his two great poems in dactylic hexameter, and he nowhere gives the impression that his chosen meter is a restriction. On the contrary, he seems to us as we read him, especially as we read him aloud, as free as a dolphin ranging through the wide waters of the Aegean. He can go anywhere and do anything. I'm not, of course, insisting that all poems should be written in meter. That would be very stupid. I'm only saying that many of the great poems of the world, even right now, use meter as a structural principle, just as many modern painters still use frames in their pictures. So what should present-day writers do with things like meter? I'm sure everyone listening has ideas on this question. Anyway, while here on this side of the Pacific, I have one answer given by a very different poet from Robert Frost. I'm speaking of E.E. Cummings, and you may recognise that name possibly because he wrote it all in lowercase letters. That doesn't tell us anything much, but the poem will. Cummings was a very well-educated poet, but he tried to conceal all that by using a very familiar everyday language and keeping out of his poems anything that had the faintest whiff of the academy. He once gave a series of lectures at Harvard which he called Six Non-Lectures, in which he tried to stay away from the lecture format as much as he could, and he succeeded in teaching us a great deal. His poems are full of surprises, and he wrote some very beautiful poems, one of which ends with a tribute to the woman he apparently loved very much. The last line of that poem is, "Not even the rain has such small hands." I don't know about you, but that line's kept me awake many nights, squirming with envy. The poem I'm going to share with you now is definitely not one of Cummings' love poems, however. In fact, it would be difficult to say what kind of a poem it is. It seems to explode out of nowhere, and the title hurls us straight into the poem itself. Buffalo Bill's defunct, who used to ride a water-smooth silver stallion and break 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 pigeons just like that. Jesus, he was a handsome man. And what I want to know is, how do you like your blue-eyed boy, Mr. Death? Then the poem falls back with Buffalo Bill into nowhere, leaving us a little lost here on this other side. A poem like that needs no comment, so I won't make one. Well, today we've made a small journey into the country of poetry and sound and silence, and I've tried to show how sound can very often be a way of revealing what a poem says. Next time we'll take a journey once again across the Pacific. I think you'll find the sound of that voice very engaging. Until then, good reading and good listening.
Today on Poetry on the Radio, Canberra-based poet and literary thinker Keith Harrison has shared with us some thoughts on poetic craft and how we, as poets and readers, can speak poems into fuller, more vibrant life. On our next program, he'll talk about the 20th century American poet Robert Frost, revisiting many of the ideas of today's broadcast. In the third of his three broadcasts, he'll discuss poetry about war. For Poetry on the Radio, I'm Peter Searles.
The Rhyming Bugle. On Monday, November 18, at Smith's Alternative, That Poetry Thing presents Big Open Mic at 7 p.m. Readers have 3 minutes and can sign up on the night. At the University of Canberra, on November 22 and November 23, a seminar series open to the public will be held entitled Poetry on Prescription. It focuses on healing through the creative arts. More information is available on the University of Canberra's UC Events webpage. Poetry on the Radio is produced weekly on unceded Ngunnawal country in the studios of Art Sound FM. Series hosts are Kimberly K. Williams and Peter Searles, who produced the program with me, Peter Monahan. Poetry on the Radio is heard each Sunday at 4:30 p.m. and again at 10:30 p.m. on Mondays. Find out more on the Poetry on the Radio page under the Programs tab at artsound.fm. Our theme is an imagining of an ancient Greek hymn to the muse Calliope by Gregorio Paniagua and the Atrium Musica de Madrid.